Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other infectious diseases that threaten the public's health. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
The question burning up our inbox today is also the question burning through my head, which is your reaction to the news that broke last week that Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Secretary of Health for the United States, has canceled 22 contracts comprising roughly $500 million in federal funding for research on mRNA vaccines.
Yes, and this was in addition to his canceling, I think it was $600 million in mRNA contracts with one of the pharmaceutical companies in the spring. So my reaction, this is crazy. I don't know how else to put it. It makes absolutely no sense, and it puts us in a much poorer position to deal with a pending pandemic, to push the science of mRNA further in terms of protecting human beings from diseases other than infectious diseases, like cancer. Brian, I just can't begin to tell you how foolish this is. It makes no sense. And he's replacing this, or not really replacing this, but he's taking money and putting it into the development of vaccines that have a platform that have been used for decades, that are not very flexible, don't give us the future needs that we have. I'm just baffled by his short-sightedness, his inability to understand science, his ideological, I was going to say bent, but it really is an ideological commitment in his life, not based upon anything rational or scientific. So I could go on, Brian, but I'd just be repeating myself. It puts us in danger.
Sure. A lot of the headlines were about the now vanishing prospects for an mRNA vaccine to address a breakout of bird flu, which is currently moving through dairies. We already have a big flu vaccine program that has pretty sizable manufacturing capacity. Like, what would mRNA vaccines promise to do differently or better?
Well, I think they've already demonstrated this. After 30 years of research into mRNA and mRNA vaccines, we understand it quite well, and we understand its potentials. And it was demonstrated in 2020. In less than a year, in 11 months, we produced a vaccine against COVID that was available to the American public in 11 months. Prior to that, the average time to produce a vaccine and have it available to vaccinate the American public was around 12 years. Some were a little faster than that, but not a lot. Some were longer than that. Quite a bit sometimes. Look at the difference here. Now imagine that it could be bird flu, but it may very well be another type of influenza or another coronavirus or what we call disease X, that is what we don't even anticipate, that is around the corner. It could become the fourth pandemic of the 21st century. And we would need a vaccine urgently. And we will be behind the eight ball in developing that because of Kennedy's decision that he made without any consultation with scientists, but only in discussions with his anti-vaccine crowd.
So the issue here is not just speed of development, but also speed of production. Like, my understanding is conventional influenza vaccine has to be grown in eggs. So not only does it take massive industrial facilities and chicken farms and all the infrastructure that goes into that, but like the number of doses you can manufacture in a given span of time is pretty capped. Whereas the mRNA vaccines, they just seemed able to scale up and crank out as soon as they were approved.
Yeah, you know, when the genome or the genetics of the virus that causes COVID, SARS, the virus called SARS-CoV-2, was announced to the world from the Chinese in early January. By the end of the month of January, our scientists working on mRNA vaccines had already produced a prototype for it, for the exact virus that was causing the pandemic. So that gives us an idea of how fast the technology is in, and malleable the technology is in developing what we need. And then, as you said, it can be produced very fast. Influenza is grown in eggs, and with avian flu, sometimes it doesn't grow well in eggs because this virus, the avian strains, have learned how to survive in eggs. Fortunately, we can grow it in what's called tissue culture, but that takes a long time. So we can't do these things overnight. With influenza vaccines, we produce them. We make the decision on what we want to have for the next fall. We make that decision in around the end of February, very early March at the latest. And then we get the vaccines coming into people's arms by September. So that's how long that would take. With mRNA, with the next pandemic or the next need for a new vaccine, we could do that in a fraction of that time.
We're speaking to Dr. John Swartzberg, clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health, and he's here to answer your questions. 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. That is 1-800-958-9008. There was a piece of research on avian influenza, which has been moving through dairy herds, that is still in preprint form, but got reported by Apoorva Mandavili at the New York Times because it was so notable. Very large and prestigious collection of researchers were going through dairies that had outbreaks to see where they could pick up samples of the virus, which the Trump administration has maintained as being spread by milking equipment. And basically found it all over the place, including detectable levels in the air, leading to the speculation that avian influenza may possibly have airborne transmission. I'm curious if you were able to take a look at the as of yet un-peer-reviewed paper and if you think it's solid.
I think the scientists who did the study are solid, and I think the observations that they made are consistent with the epidemiology of this disease. By that, I mean we still don't understand, fully, but we don't understand very well how this virus continues to transmit from cow to cow, from herd to herd, from cow to animals like cats, and from cow to humans. So we don't understand the transmission very well. And this just gives us a further glimpse at how this virus may spread. Through the air, it gets aerosolized in people or other cattle or other animals can inhale that and then get infected. So yes, it's a preprint. Yes, it hasn't been gone through peer review yet, so we have to wait for all those things. But it just adds another hypothesis that needs to be confirmed. And if it is confirmed, it's going to change the way we approach transmission.
When you say the epidemiology already supported this, that means the pattern of spread, which animals and farm workers got infected, suggested that it was spreading by means other than surface contact?
It suggested that there are likely other means besides what we know can effectively transmit it. That's right. The other thing that things that came out were that scientists have found, this goes back to 2006, have found influenza virus on the legs of and bodies of flies. And now, within the last week, reported was that the virus that causes outbreaks that we're seeing in dairy herds right now, H5N1 influenza, have been found on the legs and bodies of flies. Could this be another means of transmission? And then the other thing that came out last week, which was interesting in terms of transmission, was that the observation that cattle, particularly lactating cows, will often lick the teats of other cows to get milk, to get energy. And this is apparently a well-known behavior that I didn't know anything about. So that would be a way of one cow that's infected with H5N1 in its mouth because the receptor sites are there for the influenza virus, could lick the teat of another cow getting milk and transmit the virus that way. All of this goes to show that this is a challenging area that requires a lot more scientific effort. And coming back to our earlier discussion, all of the cuts to CDC, to USDA, to the FDA that have occurred during the Trump administration make it more difficult for a lot of these observations to be confirmed and to be really even hypothesized.
1-800-958-9008 to put your Corona Calls question to Dr. John Swartzberg. First on the line, we have Lynn in Richmond. Good morning, Lynn. Whoops, we juggled our connection to Lynn. Now we've got Susan in San Francisco. Good morning, Susan.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for this valuable program. My husband and I are in our 70s and 80s, respectively. We've kept up with our vaccinations for COVID. Going forward for the rest of this year and into next year, what is our best bet in terms of staying vaccinated? And secondarily, what is the doctor's feeling about the measles epidemic in Canada? We do travel to Canada. And I assume that if we have measles antibodies from childhood vaccinations, we're okay. Should we be getting some sort of booster on that? And thank you very much.
Susan, hold on a second. Let's get some more information about you and your husband. When was the last time you got vaccinated for COVID?
Earlier this year,
How much earlier?
about 6 months.
About 6 months ago.
But
And have you been infected with COVID since then?
Both of us have had COVID, but we took Paxlovid, and that was some time ago. We have not had any COVID recently, no.
Okay. Dr. Swartzberg, what should they be doing to stay kept up?
Well, as Susan is querying, she and her husband should get vaccinated roughly about 6 months after your last vaccine. And the reason for that is that we know that if we look at who's hospitalized and still who's dying from this virus, it's primarily people over 75 and over. But we see the numbers going up really at age 50 and really going starting to go up more significantly at age 65, but it's especially 75 and over. So I think that it makes absolute sense for Susan and her husband to get vaccinated again, roughly maybe a month from now, if it's been 5 months. But what's interesting about Susan's question is why is she confused about this, or why is there a question about this? If you remember back a year ago, we knew at this time of the year, we knew actually a month or two or three, and 2 months ago, that in the fall of 24, there would be a vaccine. We knew exactly what the vaccine was going to be composed of and when it was going to be available to people and who for whom it was recommended. Fast forward to this year, because of the intentional confusion created by HHS, created by Kennedy and his ilk, we haven't even had the advisory committee to the CDC give their opinion, give their advice to the CDC, which is critical for moving things forward. They haven't even done that yet. Ostensibly, they're going to be meeting later this month to make that decision. And we don't even know what that decision is. And given the composition of the ACIP now, it's very It's very unpredictable because most of these people are anti-vaccine. So that's where her confusion comes from. That's where my confusion comes from, and everybody's confusion comes from. Intentional confusion to make it more difficult for people to understand and get the vaccine. All of that said is I can only predict now, I can only guess, but I think the vaccine is going to be available. It's been approved for people 65 and over and younger if you have underlying health conditions. So I think it will be available. We have a pretty good idea that the two mRNA companies that produce it, Pfizer and Moderna, will have their products available by sometime in September, which would be good timing for Susan and her husband. Novavax, still question marks, but it should be available for people. I'm not sure exactly when because it's an older technology and takes longer to produce, as we were talking about earlier. So, bottom line, Susan and her husband should get vaccinated roughly 6 months after the last time, and the vaccine should be available and should be paid for by Medicare. But still question marks related to that because of RFK Jr. and his ilk. In regards to Susan's second question about measles going to Canada, if you have had measles and you're sure you've had measles, or if you've been vaccinated with the effective measles vaccine that became available in 1969, but really became widely used in the early 70s. If you've been vaccinated, then you don't have to worry about getting measles. The vaccine, if you've had both the two doses of it as a child, it's going to continue to protect you. And roughly about 98% of people who get the vaccine, 97 to 98% of people have a great response for much of their life, if not all of their life. So you don't need any more vaccines. Where it gets confusing is that people in their 70s and 80s may not have gotten the updated vaccine that came out in 69. And if they didn't get that vaccine, if they got the one that was available between 63 and 68 that was not very effective, then they need to know that either they have antibodies or they need to get vaccinated again with the newer one.
So let's assume that's a question mark for Lynn, because very few of us have well-preserved medical records or memories from 55 years ago. Is the best course of action just to get the measles vaccination series again to be safe, or to ask her doctor for a titer to find out if she has the antibodies currently in circulation in her system?
Yeah, I think if there's a question, then the blood test is not very expensive and can tell you if you have immunity, the antibodies, as you're mentioning, Brian. Alternatively, you could get just vaccinated again, and it would be likely be one dose or maybe two doses. The argument against the latter is only that right now there's plenty of the vaccine available, but we want to make sure that people who absolutely need it get it. So if it's possible, get the antibody test. If it's positive, you don't have to worry. If it's negative, then you get vaccinated.
Got it. So not a big downside to getting vaccinated, except if there's a shortage of vaccine, you want to make sure you need it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Next up, we've got Lynn in Richmond. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning. Thank you so much. I appreciate your show. My question is that I have COVID, and I, what's this day four? And I'm on day four, and I wanted to take Paxlovid, and I got Kaiser to prescribe it, but it cost $1,550, which is too expensive. So, and I have Hashimoto's, which is a thyroid thing, and I just want to make sure that it's not the wrong choice to not go get it, because I think I could still get pick it up today. That's basically it.
Lynn, how old are you, if you don't mind telling us?
Yeah, no, I'm 59 years old, and I got the last COVID vaccine was probably about 9 months ago. Because I'm only allowed to get it once a year, and my partner got it first, and She's on day, what are you on? Day 7, and she couldn't get Paxlovid. She's on Medicare, but they wanted to charge her $850 for Paxlovid. And we're both taking some homeopathy along with other over-the-counter stuff.
It shouldn't be this way. This is my best answer. I feel very, very strongly for people who are 65 or over. If they get COVID, regardless if it's mild, appears to be a mild case or a severe or a moderate case, they should take Paxlovid. I feel very strongly about that. I see little downside for taking Paxlovid and an upside for taking it if you're younger than 65, because it has clearly demonstrated that it shortens the course of illness, helps prevent hospitalization, and that means helps preventing death. So it's really very worthwhile at any age, almost any age, but especially in people who are at higher risk. So you're not on Medicare, you're not over 65. I can only speak for myself. If I was your age, I would take the Paxlovid. But $1,500 would be a big barrier to that, even for people in...
$1,550.
$1,550. I don't know what to say. I hate the idea that we have to balance the cost of something with our health.
How it's much also... risk am I forgetting COVID if I don't take it?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last question.
How she's asking how much risk she's exposed to if she doesn't take it.
Well, her risk of getting really seriously ill at her age, even with the Hashimoto's, which should not alter her course, is her risk of getting seriously ill is low. COVID would reduce that low risk even lower. Paxlovid would reduce that low risk even lower.
And Dr. Swartzberg, I think it's worth reviewing because there's been kind of conflicting studies on this. Is there a consensus that Paxlovid does anything to affect the likelihood of long COVID after an infection?
There's not a consensus, but there is quite a bit of data to suggest that it does. Most of the studies that have been done have shown Paxlovid has a benefit of reducing the risk of developing long COVID by a low of 30%, in some studies as high as 60%. So it clearly is taking Paxlovid appears to reduce the risk of long COVID. When I say there's not a consensus, because there have been some conflicting studies that haven't shown a benefit.
But if I'm not mistaken, the studies that showed a significant effect skewed towards study populations that were older, like using the Veterans Affairs database.
That's correct.
All right. Well, Lynn, I'm sorry you have to navigate that financially and intellectually on your own. Glad to hear you're well enough to make a phone call on day 4. Good luck. Dr. Swartzberg, thank you so much for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I'd appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.